Air Force could be facing a perfect storm of personnel issues when it comes to scientific talent. It's hard to attract young scientists to government work over a higher-paid industry job. And as many senior officials seek early retirement, the Air Force is looking at a gap in its pipeline of future leaders in the science and engineering fields. Dr. Micah Ensley is the chief scientist of the Air Force, and she joins us now to talk about this issue. Dr. Ensley, thanks for coming on with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So exactly how serious is this challenge for the Air Force?
Well, it's one that we're monitoring carefully. The science and engineering workforce in the Air Force is approximately 80% civilian, and they've been hit hard over the last few years by a number of factors. They have experienced pay freezes for 3 years. This year they got a 1% increase, but it really hasn't covered even the cost of living increases in that time period. They also experienced a number of unpaid furlough days last year, and the opportunities for bonuses for outstanding performance have been, in many cases, eliminated or frozen. So there's some issues going on there that we're trying to monitor and overcome.
The increased rate of retirements and departures, especially at the senior level, do you lay that entirely or mostly at the way the workforce was treated last year, particularly with shutdown, with furlough, as you mentioned?
That's part of it, but interestingly, one of the biggest worries that I hear from our workforce when I travel around has been a government conference policy that requires approval for attendance at science and technology meetings to go all the way up to the Secretary of Air Force to get approved. This is a general conference policy that was put in place a few years back to prevent abuses after wasteful spending by GSA officials.
Mm-hmm.
This inadvertently caused a significant problem for our scientists and engineers who are really just trying to do their jobs. They need to be able to attend technical meetings really for exchange of scientific progress. It's very important for discovering what new advances are going on in other labs in academia and industry. It's important for their career progression and for meeting with other scientists that are working on similar problems just to make sure that our programs are on track and to make sure that we're getting the latest findings into our work. Because this approval has begun such a lengthy and difficult process, it's created a lot of uncertainty. And we've seen really across different technical fields that attendance at technical meetings by scientists and engineers from across the government has really become log-jammed. We're losing key leadership positions in technical fields that are being taken over by non-U.S. researchers in many cases. So this is a real concern across the government. It's a little bit better this year for smaller conferences in the U.S., in the Air Force, but it's still quite difficult and lengthy process. So we're looking at this unintended consequence of the policy that's been a real significant frustration for scientists and engineers who feel like it's preventing them from being able to do their jobs, and it's worked to discourage many from staying in government service.
On the conference issue, I mean, it seems to me that across DOD there's kind of a wide recognition at this point that the conference policy was an overreaction. In fact, Frank Kendall, the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, has used exactly that word when he's talked about this over the past few months. I believe, issued a memo, actually, a few months ago saying, look, especially for science and engineering people, this is part of their jobs and they need to be doing it. They need to be traveling. Has that had any effect on this issue so far, as far as you can tell?
Not too much. Within the Air Force, we were able to get some concessions this year where for smaller meetings where we don't have as many people attending, then only the head of the Air Force Research Lab has to approve it. But for any larger conference, which like an IEEE meeting, for example, would be, it's still a challenge. There is currently a review of this policy that GAO is heading up, looking at the impact that it's had on scientists and engineers across the government, and we are participating in that review. And hopefully we can get this turned around in the near future. I think it would be a big help.
Across that spectrum of 26,000 people doing science and engineering things in the Air Force, I'm sure that's a pretty diverse field of stuff that folks are working on. Are there particular niches within that that you're particularly worried about in terms of not having the expertise now or in the future?
We're not seeing it too heavily concentrated in particular technical fields. What we're seeing is really it's occurring differentially across the age ranges. So we face an interesting challenge with our workforce in that we have more people who are over 50 or under 35 than we do in the mid-career age ranges. And this was due to a lack of hiring in the mid-90s when the defense industry shrunk at the end of the Cold War. So now what we're seeing is that as our older workers are retiring, we're losing a lot of that expertise, and we're going to need to increase hiring considerably in order to keep up and really focus on training and learning opportunities for this younger workforce. I think there is an upside there in that the younger workers coming into the Air Force are going to have considerable opportunities to move up quickly and take on new responsibilities and get job growth. So it's actually a very good time to begin your career in the military.
So the younger workforce that's already in there, is it a matter of just sort of accelerating their career growth and development so they're ready to take over for those more senior folks and sort of jump ahead of where you've got that bathtub?
It is, and it's a matter of retaining those people, and it's a matter of recruiting new people to come into the government. So some of the negative effects that we've seen from the conference policy and the financial factors that have affected government workers in the last few years are sort of having a real negative impact at a time when we need to be accelerating recruitment and retaining.
And so what are you doing to accelerate? Tell me some of the specific things that you're doing to get after this problem.
Well, we have a number of programs in place. There is, across the DOD, some scholarship programs. The SMART scholarship program, for example, helps pay for tuition while people are in school in highly sought-after STEM fields. We have a second program called Pathways in Palos Acquire that allows us to recruit in key areas and also send people to get their master's degree, for instance, in some of these STEM fields. So we have a number of things that are directed at that young workforce. What we really need to make sure of is that we're able to act aggressively to bring in and hire them and get over some of the hiring freeze problems that we've had.
How much, if any, of this is budget-driven? I mean, if Congress enacted President Budget 15 as it was proposed, does that give you the funding that you need in order to make these hires?
I think a great deal of it is budget-driven. So we really do need stable R&D funding. And the good news is that President Obama and Secretary of Defense Hagel have recognized the importance of continuing our research and development funding. If we can get that stabilized and see that through, then the stability really helps when it comes to recruiting people into the government in these science and engineering career fields. That's been one of their big concerns, is this perceived loss of stability. One of the challenges that we have, though, is that with the continuing specter of sequestration, we really don't know what's going to happen, and the uncertainty that produces overall in terms of different programs and in terms of R&D research, it has been a significant challenge. So anything we can do to remove uncertainty, I think, would be a big help.
In my lead into the interview, I mentioned that you're facing stiff competition from industry in terms of getting new hires. But I've been hearing from the defense industry a fair amount lately that they're having trouble, too, that the people with STEM backgrounds, the really best and brightest in the country right now, are seeing more Silicon Valley type jobs as the sexy place to be right now rather than the defense industry. Is that a concern to you from a government perspective, that perhaps, you know, your industrial partners are also having trouble attracting that STEM talent?
It certainly is. And if you look at how our products are produced, our military products, a great deal of those are produced in industry. So they're very much a partner in this process. It really goes, though, to the core factor of how we're doing with STEM graduates in this field, and science, technology, engineering, and math areas. The U.S., for instance, produces 4% of our college graduates are in engineering. In China, it's over 30%. We're also looking at China experiencing 11% annual growth in R&D spending, whereas we're basically flat. Those are real concerns that we need to be paying attention to. We're looking at how are those engineering graduates being used. I've recently looked at engineering publications, which are a significant mark of research productivity. In the U.S., in the year 2000, the United States had the lead over all other countries, and we produced something like four times as many engineering publications as China. In 2007, China overtook us, and in 2012, they were producing twice as much as the U.S. So we're seeing a real growth in engineering productivity in other countries that really needs to be a wake-up call for us. I think we tend to think that what we're doing in the defense industry, we have the best technology ever and nobody can touch us. And I think that's a little bit of complacency. It may be true right now, but that's changing very rapidly. So we've been looking at facing significant budget cuts when much of our fleet is aging and needs to be replaced or modernized. We have a transport and tanker aircraft that are over 40 years old, for example. And we're also at a time when we're facing many new challenges in areas like cyber, unmanned vehicle proliferation and hypersonics. So we're at a real crux here technologically of really needing to put the speed on in order to maintain our technological edge at a time when other countries are able to innovate much more rapidly and have much more workforce to direct at this problem.
Yeah, I'd like you to play that out for me a little bit more before you go. You know, obviously the Air Force S&T program is not just a jobs program. It's ultimately about producing military capability. When you
Absolutely.
Look at the workforce impacts on, you know, producing military capability and generating innovation, how do you think about, you know, the nexus between those two things?
Well, one of the things we know is that the amount of funding that we put into R&D has a significant impact on innovation across the economy. It's been one of the significant drivers of the economic growth over the past five or so decades, where those investments come back to bear not just in our military products, but also in terms of the kinds of products that you see out in industry. So, for example, if you go back to our Silicon Valley example, on your iPhone today, you have devices where you can use touch screens and you can interact with voice commands on an artificial intelligence agent. I worked on those technologies in the 80s when I was a young engineer working in the defense industry. We were doing a lot of the basic research on those for fighter aircraft.
Mm.
We're now seeing those come out in the commercial industry. So a lot of that technology change that people take for granted in their commercial products actually came out of militarily funded R&D that's been done years ahead of time. And I think a lot of times people don't realize that.
All right. Well, Dr. Ensley, thanks very much for coming on with us once again, and I wish you the best of luck in trying to tackle this challenge.
Thank you so much.